in some ways, I think that motherhood is the catalyst for my best work. I think that the way that it overtook everything, I was fighting so hard against it that I had this drive to work because otherwise I was going to disappear. And it's also so much of what I wrote about for at least 10 plus years. In some ways, motherhood made me the writer I am today. It's this and, you know, like it does both things.
I'm your host, Caitlin Salamini, and this is the Postpartum Production Podcast. Here, we hold conversations about the intersection of caregiving, creative practice, and capitalist production, as well as what it means to be producing art while also being a parent in modern society. Find out more at www.postpartumproduction.com, where you can also sign up for our newsletter.
Happy summer, wherever you are. Hope that everything is healthy and well in your lives. I know from here it's been a summer of a lot of sort of unexpected jolts, but making it through and enjoying the sun as we can. This is a bonus episode to follow on our season's closing, and I'm excited to share this one with everyone today. So, as a little bit of an intro, this episode is a live recording of an event that took place on Tuesday, July 1st. So it's been a hot minute. Sorry, it took me a while to put this together. But it was an evening of conversation and reading on love, labor, and fury with Minna Dubin, the author of Mom Rage, The Everyday Crisis of Modern Motherhood, and myself, along with the incredible guest facilitator and Postpartum Production Podcast mega fan, who I appreciate so much, Megan Leonard, who is a poet and is based in New Hampshire. So this event took place at Laney and Lou, which is a wonderful restaurant and community center in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And so just as a little bit of intro, Minna Dubin, who's been featured on this podcast several times, Minna is the author of Mom Rage, The Everyday Crisis of Modern Motherhood. Her writing has been featured in the New York Times, The Times Sunday Magazine, Oprah Daily, Lit Hub, Salon, Electric Literature, and more. She's the recipient of an Artist Enrichment Grant from the Kentucky Foundation for Women, and as a leading feminist voice on Mom Rage, Minna has appeared on MSNBC, Good Morning America, The Tamron Hall Show, the BBC, and NPR. And Megan Leonard, who was the wonderful facilitator of this conversation, is the author of the poetry collections Book of Lullabies and Larkspur Queen. She is primarily a poet, but also enjoys visual art and prose, and themes in her work often include disability and chronic illness, mental illness, motherhood, and creepy fairy tales. Meg is a writing mentor and a writing assistant for the University of New Hampshire. And Megan, I'm calling her Meg, and Minna and I all met through the Artist Residency in Motherhood Facebook group called Cut and Paste, which I think I have mentioned several times on the podcast and highly recommend to anyone who is a writer and a mother. And I also wanted to mention that Megan's essay, Being a Writer Shouldn't Require Me to Exist Without My Children, was featured in Electric Lit's June 26th publication. And I highly recommend reading her essay, which just pretty much summarized so many of my feelings on how to sit in the both and of being a creative person and connecting with your children on a daily basis and what that really looks like. So definitely find that, and we'll share that in our show notes as well. Without much more, I would love to share this live conversation with you that I am very grateful that you cannot see, because the recording was pretty much just of half of our bodies, but the audio is spot on, so you can enjoy. All right, here we go.
So we're going to start with some conversation questions for Minna and Caitlin, and then they're both going to read a little bit from their work. Then we'll have one more question about support systems, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. So first, Minna, I'm going to start with you. Minna, Caitlin, and I met through a group of writer mothers that met online during the pandemic. And Minna, I remember in that time, your New York Times article titled "The Rage Mothers Don't Talk About" was reprinted during the most isolated part of the pandemic, when parents of young children were feeling a total lack of support system very acutely. And your article went viral during that time for the second time. And this led agents to reach out to you and encourage you to make it a book-length work. And I remember in our writing group, you saying, "I'm not sure this is the book I want to write." And then saying, "But I'll be really mad if someone else writes this book, so I guess I'm writing this book." So my first question is, why did you write Mom Rage? Who did you write the book for? Did you feel like you were writing it for yourself? Were you trying to help other mothers? Were you hoping to find answers for yourself through the process of research? And did your ideas about your audience change as you wrote the book?
Yeah, I did say that. You know, the essay that was published in the New York Times that went viral, "The Rage Mothers Don't Talk About," was an essay that was part of another book that lives on my hard drive. And so when all these agents reached out to me and were like, "We think you should write a book about Mom Rage," I was like, "I have this other book, though. I think you should publish this other book that's about motherhood, but about this like much wider and more complicated scope of motherhood, because Mom Rage is just like this one piece of my motherhood and this one piece of everyone who experiences Mom Rage's motherhood." And so I think I felt really nervous to write a memoir about this one topic. That was the topic that was going to be my legacy, like for my children, you know? Like, it's like, I took a while to get comfortable with it. And so I think the way that I did it was to interview all these other mothers, to not make it a straight memoir. And I think part of that was like to back myself up, to be like, it's not just me, I'm not just crazy. And look at all these moms like around the world who are experiencing this. And I think as I did that work, it changed. I don't know that I even had an audience. I just was like, somebody has to write this book. I knew that the book was needed in the world because of the response that I got from moms after the article went viral. And then once I started interviewing moms, and I just so fell in love with their stories. And I think it sort of became my book in the process of doing it, where I really loved it. And a couple months like into the writing the proposal, I got an invitation to go on a national talk show called the Tamron Hall Show. And in New York, they were like going to fly me there and like drive me around, and put me up. And I had never, ever experienced anything like that. And I was terrified. And I'm not good at like being on stage. And I was very nervous. And I called my friend, who's very wise. And I said to him, and I said, "What do I do?" And he said, "The reason why you're so nervous, that's your ego." And he said, "Who are you writing this book for?" And I said, "I'm writing it for the moms." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "To give them relief." And he said, "When you're on stage and you're nervous, just think about the moms and why you're doing this." And so I've sort of held that. And when I was writing the dedication for the book, I felt so like, this should be for my kids. Everyone writes their books for their kids. Like, for you, Brian, or whatever, you know. And I was just like, no, this is for the moms. So it ended up being my dedication too.
Yeah. I love that. Caitlin, I'm going to ask you a similar question. Like Minna, your education and background is primarily in fiction writing, and you published your first novel, Empire of Glass, before becoming a mother. Then, when your third child was just, was it like 3 months old?
Less. 6 weeks old.
6 weeks old. So when her third child was 6 weeks old, she decided to start a podcast. And not just like a casual podcast, like a well thought out, beautifully produced podcast, a very ambitious project. And that's the Postpartum Production Podcast, where you've hosted and produced weekly podcasts and newsletters for multiple seasons, interviewing dozens of mother writers and mother artists. And anyone familiar with your podcast knows right away it's a deeply creative endeavor, but it's also really different from writing a novel, and I would assume a really different process. Again, what is it like to sort of pour your creative energy, which presumably is not something you have tons of extra time and energy, right? And to pour your creative energy into this podcast, were you motivated by trying to help other moms?
Were you looking for something in the process or both? And now having gone through the three seasons of the Postpartum Production Podcast, do you feel like your motivations for the work has shifted, or has your sense of audience and purpose shifted as well?
So yes, I was 6 weeks postpartum and I was mostly feeling really alone in my work, and I was seeking community, and I did not intend to start a podcast, actually. I thought, I want to hear, I guess similar to Minna in many ways, I wanted to hear what other people had experienced in this moment of new and early motherhood, especially, you know, regardless of the type of work you're doing, but just to really understand what was possible and what the constraints were. So both, I think the constraints and the challenges were like the obvious part, right? But is there a possibility, and what does that look like? And how do we create a world for all of us where that possibility is more likely than not? And so I actually had a babysitter who was then studying media in London, super random. I said to myself, maybe an anthology, like maybe, like I'm a writer, maybe there are other writers, I can look at other writing that's come out of this time period in one's life and see what that looks like and put it together. That's easy-ish, kind of, right? And so I told this to this person that I thought, maybe she can help me with this. You know, I need someone to help me. I have a six-week-old and two other kids. And she said, this sounds like a podcast. And I have to say, like, I wasn't really into a lot of podcasts. I didn't listen to a lot of podcasts. I certainly am not a media host in any way. But she just sort of planted that seed, and she's like, listen to some podcasts, you know. And then it just so happened that another friend was a podcaster as well. She has an amazing podcast about grief, if anyone's looking for it. And she had a newsletter that came out, and she was doing editing. So it just sort of happened that that came in my inbox. So I thought, okay, the universe is telling me this is possible. Here are people that can support this. And I started reaching out to really just friends to start, friends who are writers who I thought might be interested in speaking. And it was just so easy to find people excited to talk about all of these subject matters that we talk about in the podcast. So that was, in some ways, it sort of fell into my lap. But also, I think ultimately, in many ways, was also a very selfish thing for me to do, because I needed to hear these stories, you know, similar to Minna's process of like, I know I needed to do this for me, but also that it was for everyone at the same time, right? That we were holding space and community in these stories and in sharing the stories. So it's a dance and an element of, you have to want it for yourself and also know that there are others that want that too. And so that was really the impetus, and wanting community.
I love that. Wanting those conversations and wanting to hear those conversations, it sounds like helped supported the creative spark. And I love that for both of you, it sounds like it was the conversations, the interviews that you really fell in love with, the talking to others about their experiences. You said a lot of mother artists were like really excited to talk to you about this. Minna, I'm curious, did you find people were really excited to talk about mom rage, or was it hard to get people to do interviews with you?
Both. I think when I first put out the call, I immediately got like a rush of people. And so the people who wanted to, who like reached out, definitely wanted to talk to me and were excited to talk to me. I had to rein it in to be like, these are my five questions. And then I started realizing the holes. Well, I don't have anyone who like has a kid but didn't birth the kid, or, you know, step parents, or people of this like racial background or class background. Like, I need to have a larger pool of motley, you know. So then it started getting tricky. I had to go to friends of friends and so put it on your social media. And it was a little trickier. And I found that in general, people wanted to talk to me about motherhood, and they came to me through rage. But then when I pinpointed them to the rage, when I was like, okay, thank you for telling me about like your birth trauma and why you're so angry at your husband and like all the other stuff. But can you take me through a rage moment, like from start to finish? That was a lot trickier for people to actually say, and they would sort of do anything not to say it, not to tell that story. But those were sometimes the most powerful parts of the interview and sort of the whole point of the interview.
When I think about how we talk about and portray motherhood in the media, and even how we talk about it amongst ourselves sometimes, it can be very two-dimensional. Like, the parameters for which a mother is allowed to exist are sometimes very narrow, right? And so I could see where really getting into those rage moments would be hard. And even some of the craving or ambition for creativity that I think mother artists experience can rub up against that line too. So my next question is kind of about that identity and how we see ourselves. So often how others perceive us is dramatically impacted when we become mothers. And so many people experience early motherhood, especially, as very all-consuming and sometimes sort of flattening of their identity, both physically and emotionally. Minna, in Mom Rage, you explore the idea that anger and rage can be reasonable responses to the claustrophobia of motherhood. And you quote, is it Soraya Chemeli? Is that how you pronounce?
I think it's Soraya Chemeli.
I was way off. Soraya Chemeli, who writes, anger begets transformation, manifesting our passion and keeping us invested in the world. It is a rational and emotional response to trespass, violation, and moral disorder. I'm wondering, how has motherhood as an identity and as a consuming experience influenced your work as a writer? And do you have advice or insights for mothers who might experience the feeling of being all-consumed by their roles as mothers, even if they have other aspects of their identities that are important to them?
Yeah, in some ways, I think that motherhood is the catalyst for like my best work. I think that the way that it overtook everything, I was fighting so hard against it that I had this drive to work because otherwise I was going to disappear. And it's also so much of what I wrote about for at least 10 plus years. In some ways, motherhood made me the writer I am today. It's this and, you know, like it does both things. Before I wrote about motherhood, I did identity studies in college. So I was always obsessed with identity and the way that identity affects the way that we're perceived, how we see the world, the way that it's interacting, even just like my conversation with you or, you know, whatever. It's everywhere. And so in some ways, it didn't affect me in that I'm just still writing about identity. It's just through a motherhood lens instead of me talking about being white or whatever identity I'm choosing to talk about. And in some ways, the pandemic was this huge catalyst as well, like for this burst of creativity. Like as much as the pandemic was this incredibly difficult thing and just blew up our experience, so many of us, of motherhood. My experience is that when I became a mother, my lens got super small. Like everything I was like concerned with was in my house. I stopped seeing outside for a while. And then the pandemic, it was like a tinder fire. And so I think I felt all of this pressure. And so the writing came out of the pandemic. I don't know if that answers the question
exactly.
Yeah. It's like, it's everything.
Everything all at once. Caitlin, a similar question for you. How has your creative work bled into your mothering experience and vice versa? How has your experience of becoming a mother influenced what you want to create and what stories you want to tell? Yeah, and identity as a mother, but also experiences of living in a body with kind of the physical and emotional demands of motherhood. And how has that affected the work that you find yourself drawn to and engaged in?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I know we're not all writers here, but I think that when we are caregivers, whatever that person we're caring for, whether they're elder or younger, right, we are never fully in our own bodies. We're always like navigating other bodies. And I think that for me, as a creative writer who then has to take time to try to process how to put stories on a page, I couldn't. Literally, speaking of the pandemic, working through that and having children at home so much, I couldn't ignore their voices. Like they were so present. And so one of the works that I started working on after Empire of Glass, it's now becoming my third book. I thought it was my second book. And then this other book took over that I'm finishing now. But even in both of them, I mean, there's so many themes, but literally in my third book, there are interruptions of motherhood on the page because I couldn't not put what my bodily experience of being a mother and being a writer looked like. And so I had to really interrupt the experience. Like I needed those, like it's just constant interruptions. I mean, really, right? I mean, caregiving is constant. It's just a life of interruptions. And I think creative processes, right? I mean, you think of all of the white male writers that we, you know, have in the American canon that had no interruptions. Writing a novel is not something you do where you have interruptions. It's very difficult to do with interruptions. It is a long form process as a book of nonfiction. And so I've been trying to, I think in my work, to understand what that will look like and to disrupt in many ways what the typical book, if you will, or creative work looks like that often is one that is set and built in a place that so many people don't live in and mm-hmm. work in, right? Mm-hmm. And so just thinking about that and what that means when you're creating something has been part of my process. So it's everything.
I forgot that you asked about advice. Mm-hmm. I think that also with the identity piece is that I think that I worked so hard publishing my writing once I became a mother because I was so interested to be something other than mother. Like that felt so incredibly crucial to me at that moment. And then the other thing about advice is just in general that I try very hard not to give advice. It's funny, if you read Mom Rage as a, this is a person who's trying really hard not to give advice. You can see it. So I don't have any advice, except I guess I would say to, you know, if you're feeling that, to like find the thing that makes you feel alive.
So one of the things I love about Mom Rage is that I feel like I can hear that you're not giving advice, mm-hmm. right? You're presenting stories, essentially, and they're well-researched, and you have so much research that supports and deconstructs the stories and informs the stories. But at the heart, the thing that drives the book are these stories that don't fit into this narrative that we've been given. And I love this idea of the book that you're working on now and how it sort of disrupts and upends what we're taught to think of as narrative, right? From a lens that doesn't necessarily include mothers. So to that end, I'd love to hear from both of you. I'd like you to read from both of your pieces. We'll start with Minna, if that's okay.
Sure.
And can you read from Mom Rage?
I sure can. Okay, I'm gonna read from chapter 4, which is called Matrescence, which is the life phase of becoming a mother. It's called Matrescence and the Gaslighting of Mothers. And it's going to start with a little epilogue or epigraph, which I love so much that I'm going to read it out loud. It's from the book Night Bitch. And if you don't know that book, I highly recommend it. It's a novel that is sort of Mom Rage novelized. Her sense that society, adulthood, marriage, motherhood, all these things were somehow masterfully designed to put a woman in her place and keep her there. This idea had begun to weigh on her. And once she was stripped of all she had been, her career, her comely figure, her ambition, her familiar hormones, an anti-feminist conspiracy seemed not only plausible, but nearly inevitable. It's by Rachel Yoder. The journey into motherhood begins with the body. Regardless of whether the mother births the baby, or the baby is adopted, fostered, or born via surrogate, or whether the mother breastfeeds, chest feeds, or bottle feeds, the mother's body changes. Her new body is for rocking and comforting, wiping crevices clean, pushing marshmallow arms through sleeve tunnels, and giving gentle baby caresses. Later, the mother's body will be for restraining her newly wiggly and non-compliant child, so she can get his diaper or seatbelt on, for hugging the tantruming child or digging her nails into her palms as she waits the tantrum out, for firmly holding wrists when the child hits her repeatedly, for running faster than she has ever run, with arms outstretched to reach the child before he swan dives into the street. Her body is a catch-all for her child's body and emotions all day, every day. Long after birth, the mother remains a container. As a mother's body morphs in its physique and range of purpose, so do most other aspects of her life. A mother doesn't just have a new baby, she has a new life. She spins on a new axis. What used to be day and night bleed into each other until there is just a ticking clock with a smattering of numbers playing musical chairs. She has a new job, a sharp learning curve, a changing set of priorities, a shifting relationship dynamic if she's partnered, and an altered sense of her value in the world. A mother is so enmeshed with her child as she shimmies her way into her new identity that she often loses sight of her previous one, her former complexities fading until she is just mother. I overhear a pregnant woman say to her friend, "I don't want to lose myself once I become a mother." What self? I think as I pass by her. She is already gone. Even her name begins to disappear. It is 2013, and I am pointing out the yellowfish swimming in the tank to three-week-old Ollie, watching his eyes to see if he can focus on it. Mom, do you have his immunizations? Mom? Mom? I turn, startled. The receptionist at the pediatrician's office is standing behind the desk, reaching her hand out through the hole in the glass partition, looking at me expectantly. Oh, I laugh and press my hand to the place my chest should be, which instead is Ollie, snug against me in a baby wrap. You're talking to me? Why is she calling me Mom, I wonder. My name is in the computer, isn't it? On all the documents? I remember the hospital personnel calling me Mom after I gave birth to Ollie. It felt warranted then, an honorific that properly acknowledged pregnancy and birth and my transition to the other side, the mother side. But now out in the world, away from the miracle and carnage of the birthing room, it sounds so strange. I will experience this over and over. When I am in public with my kids, my name ceases to matter. Strangers everywhere, at my kids' school, the playground, the bus, the YMCA, call me Mom. I wonder why people feel they have access to a name that belongs in my children's mouths. It's as if the world is relieved I am finally something capturable. Pre-motherhood, I was slippery, a thousand tiny silver fish. A woman, a writer, a friend, an educator, a queer person, a performer, a Philly girl, a Bay Area transplant, a wife, a lefty Jew. With nothing to lose, no property, no fancy job, no kids, I was a flight risk. I could do or say anything. But now that I have children, I can't stray too far, mouth off too much. There are children to consider, to feed, to pick up from school. Mothers have obligations, schedules, other people to put first. My name has been erased, and I'm reduced to one role, one thing. As a mother, I am palatable, contained, tethered. People know how to categorize my mother self. I'm Minna, I say, smiling at the receptionist, like our mutual friend just introduced us, as I give her Ollie's immunization forms. Then I put out my hand to shake hers. She places her cool, limp hand in mine, searching my eyes for hints of madness. I'm trying not to lose my very self, my eyes reply. She pulls her hand back carefully. The doctor will be right with you.
Thank you so much. And Caitlin, I'd love for you to read from your new work. So Caitlin's working on something new, and I've convinced her to read from that today, if that's all right.
Thank you all again for being here. As Meg was saying, I have a book of fiction that came out in 2017. I will correct you. It was published after my first child was born, but barely. It was tight. And so I wrote it all before. So that's a very important distinguishing point. And I have published shorter pieces since then. I have not published a longer work of fiction, but I started working on this book. It's so funny, Minna, that you're talking about the pandemic and being inspired during the pandemic, because I actually started working on this book during the pandemic. And I had been working on a different book during the pandemic, but this was, I thought, a short story that I was starting to work on, and it ballooned into something much bigger. So it is based in Kauai in the North Shore. I don't know if anyone here has been to the island of Kauai. But anyway, I will just dive in, but it definitely features motherhood too. So I think you might be lost a little bit because it's fiction, but we'll just go with it. Okay. There was nothing surprising to Veronique in the sudden compulsive need to write a story about Hanalei after reading a mediocre story about Hanalei Bay by her favorite author, Haruki Murakami. And that all of it, reading and writing, occurred on a couch above that brilliant Emerald Bay itself, her slack breast in her child's mouth, a kindergartner sucking like limpet to stone. But that's a terrible simile for an act not permanent. Wait, is it? Have you ever pried a limpet from volcanic sea rock? Okay, sometime before reading Murakami, stationed on a perch above Hanalei Bay, Veronique dreamt of sitting at the bottom of a rainbow. Is sitting in a rainbow possible? She didn't know. Fittingly, menahune, the Hawaiian version of leprechauns, were everywhere she turned. The property manager, Lisbeth, joking they turned off the house's electricity. She saw them again in a plucky illustration on the side of a Menahune plumbing truck. Then later, in the footsteps, she and her daughter, Ada, heard on the roof of their staged villa in view of the 35 waterfalls, the kindergartner counted. Yet Veronique thought, a famous middle-aged Japanese writer says whatever mediocre ramblings he wants about a foreign island, and the Guardian swallows it like foregone fellatio. Meanwhile, she's on a scouting attempt for her firm's third island development and could disappear off the Princeville cliffs without anyone noticing. Add to that, the Kahio landslide blocking entry to Hanalei, singing with Ada while waiting in traffic, Puff the Magic Dragon, Live by the Sea, I'm not going to sing it, and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Hanalei, a mild bout of mastitis, and the pandemic forcing everyone into sad, solitary confinement. You can't write fiction this good, she thought, because when she wasn't breastfeeding a kindergartner or an executive at a real estate development firm, she dreamed of writing. Just dreamed, mind you. Never accomplished. Not one sentence typed into a word processor or hand-scribbled in a leather-bound diary. Her words existed only for herself. There was an exemplary magic in this, or so she told herself, in her thoughts, not in this story, nor on any material page. At the playground the second day after her negative COVID-19 test allowed her entry to the island from Honolulu, the tight-lipped military officers guarding the airport, like Menahume, really do exist. She pushed Ada on her swing, her daughter giggling. Nearby, Nene geese waddled, reminding her of the old white women in hibiscus tunics palming mangoes at the weekly farmer's market in the canary yellow Princeville Shopping Center. This island is all color, she thought, unlike her drab office life in San Francisco. At the swings next to V, another mother pushed her very blonde daughter beside them, chubby tan legs swinging vigorously. The equally tan mother lamented over the phone to a faraway friend that she couldn't wait to get off the island. Island fever, right? I'm like literally looking into flights right now. Literally, Veronique thought, rolling her eyes at the irony, or whatever it was that made this woman so indefinably detestable to her. She must know I'm an outsider, desperate to fit in with the local beach vibe with my rubber flip-flops and truck stop hat. How eager she was to abandon the pandemic stress of an American city, whichever one, they all look the same. Boarded up storefronts, empty playgrounds, homeless encampments spilling over sidewalks. Veronique and all of Dreamland Development Partners knew the allure of islands. Is this an island? Ada was eavesdropping as well as she swung back and forth, feet off rhythm with the swing. Like in most things, Veronique and her daughter took longer to match their bodies to the world around them, each gangly and tripping over their own feet. An inheritance clearly not from her mother's side of the family, the Grecian peripatetic way of walking, or so she was told by her overly confident footshore Greek aunties. Yes, indeed. See all that water? Veronique gestured to the horizon. Sloped below the playground was a wide green golf course nearly careening into the sea. Hawaii is comprised of 137 islands, she said, as her long-limbed daughter asked to be pulled from the swing, then ran to the play structure to climb up the downslide. Veronique trailed behind, history lesson on hand, courtesy of Dreamland's marketing materials. We're on the oldest island, rich in species both native and invasive. Ada slapped headfirst down the slide on her stomach, skidding like a lazy hamster. What's invasive? Her daughter looked up from the slide, blue eyes sluiced by sun. Invasive means something that's not supposed to be in that place, doesn't live in its original home, like those trees over there. Veronique motioned to a copse of very tall trees with spinet-like limbs at the edge of the playground. They looked African, yet appropriate to this tropical landscape. Veronique knew otherwise. 2 years earlier, on her first scouting mission to the island, a farmer at Kilauea Market pointed to the terrifyingly high and expansive albizia trees in broad canopy above them. The fastest growing tree in the world, he said. Albizia grow 15 feet a year, but have terrible root systems, can topple at any time, lose limbs, and kill unsuspecting people below. The irony is they were imported to reforest the island, he'd said, as she'd edged her way a body away from the tree's shadows. Veronique didn't tell the farmer that the trees are a good metaphor for most people in her life. So eager to reach the sun, they forget to nourish strong roots. So those trees are strangers here, Ada said, as Veronique pulled her daughter's trucker hat, the one they'd bought together at their favorite shave ice shop, more squirrely over her head. Yes, she smiled. You could put it that way. Okay, one more slide. Mama has to go to work. After her last slide, Ada grumbled as Veronique took her by the hand, pulling her towards the parking lot while the girl's body leaned backwards in that parental tension between coercion and force. I'm going to stop there. That's where the it sounds like mom rage.
We have one more question and then I'm going to open it up to the Q&A. But since this is a community night, I wanted to talk about community and structural supports. I feel like in the mainstream media, what we often hear told is that moms need support and families need support and parents need support. But it's sort of like then we're supposed to create it for ourselves, perhaps. I'm not sure exactly. There, nothing goes beyond the statement that it's needed. So how would pursuing a creative life or identities outside of motherhood or in addition to motherhood be different if we had networks of care, community care, and reliable social support systems? What are some parts of those systems that you think are most crucial? And also, given the reality that we are not going to have affordable child care and parental leave and safe schools and some of the things that I think probably all of us know we need, those are not going to appear tomorrow. And unfortunately, given the state of our wider world, probably not going to appear for us anytime soon. How can we find what we need in other ways or within these imperfect structures? And what should we be fighting for right now? How do we create systems of care for ourselves when we're already depleted?
Big question. Oof, just hearing you read that, I felt a big burden on all of us. Thinking of that question, I was thinking personally about an experience I had this last fall. It feels a while ago now. My children go to a public elementary school in San Francisco, and there's been decreasing enrollment for a number of different reasons. I would argue less demographic and actually more that a lot of people are moving to the private system. And because of that, our school was threatened with closure. And so I was the PTA co-president, and so, you know, it wasn't really a choice in that sense, but I had to step in and fight for our school, which we did as a community, and it was an incredible experience. And then, of course, there was an election after that, and things have shifted, and I've thought a lot about how to navigate what to do when you have so much that you have to care for, and right, when we're talking about interruptions and we're talking about bodies that you don't have time for or you don't have the energy for. And that experience for me really just really drilled into my being that starting with something, one thing that's local, it's so onerous to think of the bigger things, right? Like, okay, well, we need to overturn this law or this. I think just like the littlest thing, isn't little though, right? Saving one public school that actually was 13 public schools from being closed in a district is really meaningful. And so I think that for me, it was just knowing that that was enough, that doing that work, whether it's daily, whether it's like an hour a week, like whatever that looks like, that one thing that matters to you that keeps you up at night, it sort of alleviated some of that stress for me because I felt like for a long time, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to start. What is my cause? What is my purpose? And how can I help? And I think that sort of honed it for me that I really do care about this. And so I can look at ways to improve that district, just at the district level, right? Not even thinking about the state or the federal, but I care about this. So I'm going to work on this locally. And I think that's been really meaningful. And obviously it's school-based. It involves my children. I mean, I think it's helpful because I'm at a school where it's easier, but I think that's one way that has really helped me to feel when there's so much else out there to do. And to know that obviously, you know, the Mr. Rogers quote, look for the helpers. There are other people that are doing those other things and they know what they're doing and they care too, helps me to get through the existential angst of all the work that needs to be done.
I mean, there's so many things that we need. The one that feels so strongly to me are probably universal childcare and a more patient-centered, loving medical system.
Yeah.
But taking it to a really small level, even smaller than what you were talking about, Caitlin. I wrote about it in the final chapter of my book, but I talked about, do you guys know Amanda Palmer? She's a musician.
Yes.
She was the head of the Dresden Dolls, or was in it. She's like an amazing musical artist. And she wrote this book called The Art of Asking that really impacted me. And it was about this idea of just asking for favors and offering favors, like this, which is like this really accessible idea. Like all of us can ask and offer a favor. I think about what are the micro support networks that I can create for my family. When my kids were smaller, I had a babysitting swap with like three different families. And you know, it's hard because it has to be like people who you trust, people who like their kids go to bed around the same time as your, like, you know what I mean? Like it's tricky, like there's all the things, but like it is possible of being like, hey, even if it's just like, we want to go out to dinner for 2 hours, we would put our own kid to bed, and then you would come and sit on the couch for 2 hours while we go out to dinner. And we had to be home at 10, so we can never go over 2 hours. And sometimes we'd want, like, you could ask, but you could do however you want to do it. But even that felt so nice, just to be able to be with my partner in a romantic setting. Felt, like, really important. And other just sorts of like smaller favors. We do it all the time, I think, especially as women and as mothers of the meal train, who are the people who are like making the meals. And that idea of making meals, it doesn't just have to be a meal train. It could just be like, I made, if you have the financial means, like I happen to have made extra. Would your family like half this lasagna tonight? And the other, what other parents would be like, I'm good. You know, like everyone's like, yes, I'd love to not make dinner tonight. Like just these little continuation of favors and the way that we can support each other in that way has felt really important and continues to feel really important to me.
So I do want to open this up to questions and thoughts and sharings. Does anyone have something they'd like to ask Minna or Caitlin to get us started with? Yeah, so for Minna, what were some of the themes and the heart of some of the stories you were hearing?
Yeah. I think there were a lot of themes. Like I think one of the big themes was just the sheer imbalance of labor that the mother was dealing with, and particularly the mothers who were in partnered relationships with men. And it was happening, honestly, even in some of the same-sex relationships, because it would just end up that one of them would end up taking on a more masculine role in the home, or one of them would have, you know, end up having, like, the more secure job, or the job with health insurance. And so, like, everything would sort of start to revolve around that person's work world and the other person's, you know, and it was often very, I found so common that the mom would be like, well, I just thought I would just like stop working for a little while, or I'll just go part-time. Like, I just like, I listened to so many women talk about the ways their careers disappeared. It felt so clear to me as the listener that it is by design. It is a societal design that this happens so that we can be home with the children. So lots of things like that. In terms of rage, I mean, the thing that just felt so similar, everyone has this, it's like this very physical experience for the moms. Like they could all sort of describe what was happening in their body. What would they do? Like their hands would clench, or their throat would be sore the next morning because they had been like kind of growling in their anger. So everyone had these sort of physical tells. So that was kind of cool to listen to, of like what everyone's tells were. One of the big ones was just shame, just so much shame. Like it was so hard for them to say it because A, we're so scared that if we're not the perfect mother, that our children will get taken away if we were to admit such a thing, which is real, a real concern and valid. And B, because of the idea of what a mother should be, which is perfect, it felt like they were failing as mothers. And because mother is what women are supposed to be, then you're failing as a woman too. Like you're failing as a whole person. So I found the shame and like not being able to tell people or talk about it was really deep. So for a lot of them, it just the experience of telling the story. What I listened to from the moms, was it a specific incident that they were talking about, or like a larger broad range? Yeah. It was both. I was asking for a specific stuff. I mean, I guess it was more specific, and then I would put it in this broader context.
Any other questions?
So the question is the impact of social media on how we perceive ourselves as mothers and how we feel as mothers, its impact on rage. And I'm also going to add to that question, if you don't mind, because Caitlin, of course, the podcast is media. I mean, books are too, but in, you know, we listen, it's in our ear. And do you feel like you are trying to push back against some of that media with your podcast?
It's possible that I didn't ask a ton about social media because I just like didn't personally care that much about it. But I think my understanding from what I got is just that it is part of the larger milieu of women learning, of everyone learning, actually, what are the expectations of a mother, right? And so that's part of it. The thing that I always think about social media when I'm talking about this is that it's what an amazing thing, access to like people publicly talking about motherhood in a more nuanced way. And I feel like at this point, we all know when like it's the white home with the white like tapestry, what are those yarn things, you know, and the white bed and the naked baby on the bed right before it like poops all over the bed, you know, like we all know it's fake.
I don't know. I don't think I have an answer about the women I interviewed in particular, as opposed to stop following those people. Yeah. I mean, and it's not that I'm immune. Like I get, I'm not good, that person is good, just not as much about motherhood. I get it about writers. I'm not publishing anything, you know. I think we all get it about the thing that we're insecure about.
Yeah.
Gosh. Yeah, I immediately thought of Sarah Peterson's work, Momfluenced. I don't know if you've seen that book, but she digs into the influencer world, and she's still doing a lot around motherhood and influencing and social media. So I feel like Sarah would be the perfect person. Read that book.
You can follow her on social media.
Yes, follow her on Instagram.
So the book is Momfluenced?
Momfluenced, yeah. And she lives
here
in
somewhere.
Durham, maybe?
Nearby.
Yeah, she lives in the area.
Yeah, or I just wanted to share about the podcast, because I do feel like I started listening to Caitlin's podcast when my youngest was like 10 months old or something.
Yeah.
He was a baby. And I sort of thought like, okay, is this, I have four kids. And I was like, is the fourth kid going to be the one that pushes me over the edge and I can't write anymore? Like I was really worried about this. And so I tapped into the podcast because I needed to hear other women talking about being able to write. But what I found is one of the things that made me keep listening to the podcast was hearing women just talk about wanting so many things. Mm. You know, so I think sometimes with social media, we see like this very flattening of what we want and desire portrayed back to us, as if we only want a white bed with a very clean baby. And I mean, I want a clean baby. But like, you know, the rest of it, I don't actually care that much about. It's not what I want. And I think finding media sources that show us ways that we see our own desires reflected back to us and permission to desire those things in addition to motherhood, you know, because I know both of you, we spent the morning together at the beach with our 9 kids between us. Like, we liked being with our kids. We just also like other things, too.
Like
that. And sort of having that permission to want all of it, right? And that's one of the beauties I see in the podcast. And I think finding other sources of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to say it into the mic again. But generational differences in what you found in your interviews.
Yes and no. I talked to moms in their 20s, and I talked to a mom who had her baby at 51. And it was the same. I talked to one or two grandmothers who were like, there's a grandmother rage. Who like now, like taking care of their own grandkids. They're like, this child. So I do think that it is sort of universal. And I talked to people who remember their moms raging. Like people who are now grown-ups and have grown-up kids and remember their moms raging. So I think that moms have actually always been raging. I think that the expectations of mothers have shifted some, especially with mothers going out of the home to work, but then the inside the home labor not shifting back to like to 50-50, and so now moms are doing more. Yeah, so I think that there's a bunch of different reasons why being a mom right now is extremely challenging, but that's not to say that it hasn't always been that way.
So similar to that question, actually, I was wondering if anyone had shared any difference or any stories around the intersection of postpartum and perimenopause as we're having children older, and I'll share my own backstory. It's 42. I didn't even think about perimenopause. We were going through IVF and all that, and I was slammed into horrible postpartum rage, anxiety attacks, things I've never experienced before in my life. And now that my kid is two, I'm finally kind of coming to the surface and going, wait a second, this could be like the stage of life that I'm in too. And, you know, I'm finding more resources from my own support in this postpartum perimenopause. And I'm just wondering if that theme entered your research or your lives personally, or it's also now my mission to just say that out loud. I want to put two words together, postpartum and perimenopause. Think about it.
Enjoy.
Yeah. I love it. So for the microphone, postpartum and perimenopause, let's talk about it.
All right. I will just say I'm with you because I had my third child much later, and I can't unpack what's happening. It's like, which is impact, I don't know. So I think yes, it's not something that I've encountered in the world enough, and I think there needs to be a lot more written and explored. Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the real problem here is that there's no research on anything to do with women. Because there's no funding. And yeah, I just feel like everything I come across, and I'm like, this is a problem for me, like, there's no research. I'm like, oh, you diagnosed me with PMDD? What's that? Everything could be PMDD. Could it be postpartum? Maybe. Could it be perimenopause? Maybe. I have anxiety. Is it perimenopause? Nobody knows. Like, yeah, I didn't actually come across that. People who were talking about both, perimenopause was not a big topic in my research, although now I feel like I can't walk two steps without one. So I've just aged into the conversation. So now everything feels like it's perimenopause. And yeah, I think that sounds really hard to do both at the exact same time.
Yeah, and I think we have some health practitioners in the room today. And I think this is one of these reasons why like women's health is actually a radical thing that needs attention. It's a radical. It's a sort of be asking these questions and to be taking care of women's bodies. Do we have any other questions? One message that would be good for moms experiencing mom rage to hear.
I think it's like the most basic thing, if they don't know this, would be that they are not alone. And oh, and the other, I can't just stick with mom, is that they're a good mom.
Any other questions?
Yeah. A thousand percent. And I also think like I feel robbed of the knowledge that perimenopause started so early. Mm-hmm. I remember my mom like going on antidepressants and freaking out in her 40s for like mom rage. And I think it's the understanding the correlation between your changing hormones and how you're feeling mm-hmm. is so incredibly empowering and important. And I'm a dance teacher, choreographer. I have a million, they say I have two sons, but a million girls in my life. And I feel like teaching them about their bodies and how they function is one of the most important things that I do. Because otherwise you do think it's like in your head, or you do think it's something that is wrong with you or whatever. And these things that you're feeling are so very real and biological and normal. And like, doesn't make it any more comfortable, but if you can understand that the waves that your body is riding, it does make it, for me, it brings me some element of like understanding and grace with myself. Mm-hmm. Even with my students, if they have a bad turning day, they could beat themselves up and I'm like, where are you in your cycle? It matters. Mm-hmm. It matters because you're probably clumsy today. Mm-hmm. So put it aside. Don't try to turn today. You know what you are gonna be good at? Your body's going to be really fluid. So let's stretch, because that's where your body's at. Mm. You know what I mean? And so I think, like, and like the estrogen, cool, baby. Like the postpartum and the perimenopause, they're just so close. It's like the mirror, you know? You're like, what is it? And your body's like, I don't know. But I really do think, like, listening to what feels like you and what feels like what feels in your control and outside of your control, if you can kind of tune into those things, it'll help guide you. And it doesn't make it easier. But I do think, like, I have found so much, I have felt so empowered by understanding my body and finding practitioners that help me understand that. And I have recommendations to you. Because I'm 44, and I feel like 40 was a light switch, 43 was another light switch. I feel like now is another light switch. I'm like, how many lights are in this house? I feel like it's very light in here.
I would just add to women, like, if you think something is going on,
something is going on.
Like, don't let people go, oh, it's, you know, like, something is happening.
Yeah, and it's like, it's a hormone, and it's like, you think that you're, I feel like you're, I'm from the Midwest, and I have the conversation all the time, like, is it generational? Is it regional? Where none of my friends, I mean, my best friends of like 20 years, and we'll like just find each other's birth stories. We're like, oh, you almost died in childbirth? That's so crazy. Me too. You know, we never knew that. We didn't talk about it. Because like our parents didn't talk about it, our moms didn't talk about it, you know? And so I think like talking about it is so important. Yeah. Because it is like, it's all of it. It's everything. It is something, and there are things that you can do about it.
But you gotta like go it on the path, which is daunting but worth it, you know.
Yeah, thank you for that. I really appreciate that. And I also want to add, it just made me think about with both postpartum and perimenopause, no matter like what is happening in your body or the hormone cycle that you're on, to me, in some ways, it's the same solution, mm-hmm. which is having more people taking care of the children. So that if you're having a day where you need to cry all day, you just get to do that. Because there's not just two pillars holding up the wobbly stool. Like, there's more people that you can call. Like, this idea of just the nuclear family, and that's it. And we're all alone in our little boxes on the hillside, and, like, we're all having the same exact problems. It's crazy.
Yeah. Do we have any other questions before we just launch into all chatting with each other? I like how that's headed in this direction. But do we have any other questions specifically that we want to ask Lina and Caitlin?
Yes. Do either of you remember your first experience with long range?
I mean, I think we can all remember our most recent.
I don't think my brain goes back that far. I can remember my most recent. Is that? Do you want it? Do you want like?
Yeah.
It's always about my son. My mom will understand. I have one middle son.
Okay.
Yeah, I have three: girl, boy, girl, and he's just. You know, as you say that, though, I was thinking of my brother. So I had mom rage with my brother probably, too. So I don't know if that's sister rage. Like, can we claim sister rage and daughter rage?
Yeah. I traced my rage back to my brother in my book.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So thank you for, you psychoanalyzed me in a very quick moment. I have another thought. I want to hold another. I have a thought on it.
So I don't remember like the exact first. Well, oh no, I do. So I only remember it though because I'm a writer, and so I wrote about it. And I wrote this performance piece about it, and it was when, and I write about it in the book. It was when my son was 4 months old and going through the four month sleep regression, and he was barely sleeping before that. Like, was a terrible sleeper, and we were like taking turns rocking him like every 20 minutes, like bouncing on the ball, you know, that ball. And then I would get him to sleep on, and then I would like bounce him and nurse him, and then like so slowly. Remember that? So slowly put
like
him down
there,
and I'd like walk away, and I'd like lie back down. My husband's like, you know, next to me. And like 5 minutes later, I would hear him scream, and like the like 50th time in the night that it happened, I slammed my fist against the mattress super hard. I mean, he was in the other room. It was fine. And my husband said to me, "What's wrong?" And I said, "No, he didn't say that. That's worse. I just really appreciate like the robbery of my dad."
Yeah.
He said, "What do you mean?"
Bitch.
And also, I just transformed from a bad guy to a good guy.
Like, wait.
He said, "What do you need?" And I said, "I need to not be his mother." Yeah. And of course, I didn't mean it. You know, just like in that moment, I just like needed to not be in charge of this baby. And it was like, and I felt so bad. And the next morning, I woke up and I was just. I was terrified. I was terrified that karma was going to like, I'm not even like a karma person. I was like terrified. And I like walked to his crib and I was like so afraid that like, whatever, you know, the worst thing. And I like walked over and he like looked up at me and was like, you know, that like gummy morning smile. Anyway, that was my first moment.
I'm your host, Caitlin Salamini, and this is the Postpartum Production Podcast. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a rating. This will help us reach more listeners like you who are navigating the joys and pitfalls of artistic and parenting identities. For regular updates, visit our website, postpartumproduction.com, follow us on Instagram at Postpartum Production Podcast, and subscribe to our podcast newsletter on Substack. Thank you for listening, and we are so grateful to have you with us on this journey. Postpartum may feel like forever, and sometimes it may feel very lonely, but you're not alone here.